you.
Everybody, after Sarah died, Chazal tell us that there were three miracles that were connected to the tent of Sarah that were nistalek, that were removed. There was a blessing in her dough. You ate her bread and you just stayed full for a very long time. The candle that she would light in honor of Shabbos remained burning for the entire week. And there was a cloud of glory over their tent, the cloud of the divine presence of the Shekhinah. When Sarah Imenu died, those three miracles departed. Meaning, even though Avram was alive, and Avram was, of course, obviously, a very, very righteous person, but without Sarah, that magnitude of Kedusha was unable to be attained. Now Rashi brings that when the Pasuk says Yitzchak brought Rivka into the tent of Sarah his mother, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So first of all, Rav Hirsch points out a very interesting thing. We normally think the sequence in marriage is you fall in love and then you get married. Here he says the opposite. He brought her into the tent of Sarah his mother, which Rashi says means that although she was only 3 years old, but all of the miracles of the tent of Sarah came back, because Rivka was like Sarah, and then he married her, and then he loved her, meaning to say there is a love that comes after marriage. Obviously, that doesn't mean you marry somebody you don't care about. That wouldn't make a lot of sense. But the deepest love is not the love of infatuation. The deepest love is that you build something together. When you build a home together, hopefully with children, but even without children. One has to understand that even if someone is not blessed with children yet, or sometimes forever, that does not mean their home is not a home, and that does not mean their Kedusha is not the Kedusha. Right? The shalom between a husband and a wife invites Hashem. It becomes a dwelling place for the divine presence. And that is when love is real. Love that you have before marriage is in the nature of a gambling prediction, meaning to say, looks like it might work. So we take a gamble. God willing, it'll work. Although the general divorce rate in America is one out of two don't, but because religious marriages do have divorces, but it's much, much less, thank God, and the like. So that is the idea, that it is the love that you get from building a home together that creates real love. But what's interesting is that the Ramban points out that the three miracles of the tent of Sarah actually have their parallel in miracles that existed in the Beis HaMikdash later, or the Mishkan. In the Mishkan, there were 10 miracles, but three miracles correspond to this. The Lechem Apanim, what is the showbread? Every Friday, in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, they would bake 12 chalos. By the way, here's a little misleading. When you think of chalos, you think of what we call challah. But in fact, the showbread, the lechem apanim, was matzah. It was not challah. But it was bendable matzah. Did you ever see Sfardim actually make soft matzah? It looks like a pita, but it's actually unleavened. It's called soft matzah. So the lechem apanim, every week they would bake 12 of those unleavened chalos. On Shabbos, they would put them on the gold table, right next to the Aron HaKodesh, right next to the Kodesh HaKodashim. And they would leave them on the Shulchan for the entire week. And they would eat them next Shabbos when they would replace them with the new bread that was baked. So the bread had been on the Shulchan for an entire week from Shabbos to Shabbos. And really, it was more than a week, because it was baked on Friday. So it was baked on Friday. It was not eaten till the next Shabbos. And by the way, sometimes it could even be a longer period. If Friday was a Yom Tov, they'd have to bake it on Thursday. If Thursday and Friday were Rosh Hashanah, they'd have to bake the Lechem Apanim on Wednesday. Right? You see that problem. And yet, when they would eat the bread, it was warm and fresh, just as if it came right out of the oven. Ramban points out That miracle parallels the blessing in the dough of Sarah. Right, that there was some special blessing in her food, that it sustained body and soul. And that corresponds to the mitzvah of Lechem HaPanim in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the second miracle is that the candle that she lit for Shabbos lasted the entire week till it was time to light new candles for Shabbos. Well, we know the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan as well, was lit every day. It was lit every day, but there was one candle that never went out. Actually, again, this is a misconception. They had to put it out every day because you have to relight it, but it never went out by itself, meaning it would burn until it was put out. This is not the Hanukkah story. The Hanukkah story was all the candles lasted for 8 days. But this is one candle. And that candle is called the Ner Tamid, the eternal light. Do we have an Ner Tamid here? I don't think. Is there a light above there?
No.
Okay, well, okay. But in a lot of... in a lot of shuls, you'll notice that above the ark is like a light bulb or something, you know, a facsimile of a candle. That's to commemorate the Ner Tamid, which is evidence that the divine presence rests among Klal Yisrael. Now, let me point out, the Torah doesn't guarantee there'll be a Ner Tamid. Meaning, sometimes we didn't have a Ner Tamid, meaning to say, it mentions that when the Jewish people were not righteous, the light went out. But when we were on a high madrega, they're Ner Tamid. So that corresponds to the miracle of Sarah's Shabbos candles. And finally, the idea of the cloud of glory over her tent, the Mishkan has a cloud of glory over the Mishkan. So what is the correspondence? So what do we see here? We see a correspondence between the three miracles of Sarah's tent and the three miracles of the Mishkan, later to be the Beis HaMikdash. What is the correspondence? The correspondence is that the home of a husband and a wife, which is modeled on the tent of Avram and Sarah, is in itself a Beis HaMikdash. It has the miracles of the Beis HaMikdash because it is a Beis HaMikdash. You know, there is a cliche that people say that the most important institution in the of the Jewish people is not a shul and not even a yeshiva, but it's the Jewish home, the relationship of husband and wife, of father, mother, and children. And that is why the halacha is, when you come to a Jewish community and things aren't built up yet, and you only have enough money for some things, not other things, the very first thing you have to provide for in a city is a mikveh, even before you have a shul. Because a mikveh is the mechanism that enables the relationship of husband and wife and the like. So again, for those who are married, take these words to heart. And for those who are not yet married, but Be'ezras Hashem should be soon, at least if you're looking, remember that the primacy of this relationship is so sacred that in many, many ways, the Beis HaMikdash is just an imitation of the tent of Avraham and Sarah, meaning the tent of Avraham and Sarah is the real Beis HaMikdash that exists. Yeah.
How old was Rick when she had her first child?
I didn't hear you.
How old was Rick when she had her first child?
Well, we know this. Rivka was married 20 years. Because Yitzchak was 40 when he married, Rivka was 3.
Yeah.
Yitzchak had Yaakov and Esav when he was 60. That's in the Chumash. So by definition, therefore, Rivka was 23. So she wasn't exceptionally young as a mother. You know, she was young, but not unusually young.
So that would be because she couldn't have children at the age of 3, right? That's
well, it seems to be more than that, because she certainly could have had children at the age of 18. You know, maybe she couldn't have it at 3. The Gemara says generally, a woman is generally not capable of giving birth till the age of 12.
Because I was reading the Midrash, yeah. And it said that the reason Sarah had the Shekhinah over the tent was because she kept herself pure, she went to the mikveh.
Yes.
And then because Rivka did the same thing, that the clouds came back.
Yes.
What was she doing in the mikveh? She wasn't at that level of development yet anyway.
Well, no, you have to differentiate. Again, this is problematical, but marital intercourse they could have, even if she's below the age of giving birth to children. Marital intercourse between husband and wife was a possibility, so she went to the mikveh. But you have to understand something else. In the time of both the Chumash and even the Gemara, even single women went to a mikveh. The mikveh was not only because of sexual intercourse. It was also because of purity and impurity. And a woman could certainly start being menstruating. It can be as early as 8, 9, or 10. So,
But at three,
well, that I don't know. You know, I don't know. Again, if she didn't menstruate, she didn't have to go to the mikveh.
Yeah.
So she's pure anyway. In other words, she is pure, meaning she kept purity. But it didn't mean she had to go to the mikveh because at a certain age she was not impure, so there would be no issue there. Yeah. But you have to know, in the time of Chazal, even single women had to go to the mikveh, because when a woman is a nida, in addition to marital restrictions, she is tameh. So if she touches food like truma, that truma would have to be destroyed. And if she touches pots, you know, the pots would be tameh. So as a result, if you think the laws of nida are complicated now, they were much, much more complicated then, because you were dealing with a whole other set of laws that we don't really follow today. The laws of tuma and tara, right? Not just marriage, you know, intercourse and the like. Okay, so this is something to remember about the idea of marriage. Now, we know one thing. We know that Yitzchak was not involved in the choice of his mate. Avram marrying Sarah, we don't know anything about that. We don't know how did Avram meet Sarah, but as far as we know, Terach was not the shadchan, so we have to assume that Avram and Sarah made their own arrangements. Yaakov, of course, we know. Yaakov with Lavan, Yaakov wants Rachel, he gets Leah, then he gets Rachel, etc. But Yitzchak is totally passive in this whole enterprise. Yitzchak is at home. After Sarah dies, Avram figures, got to find a wife for Yitzchak, and he sends his faithful servant Eliezer back to Avram's family to find a suitable wife, and Eliezer brings back Rivka. So one thing that's very noticeable is that Yitzchak is absolutely passive. Yitzchak simply takes the wife that Avram sent Eliezer to choose, and of course when Yitzchak sees she is a good replacement for Sarah, he realizes this is the right person. Why is Yitzchak so passive? So Rashi understands the following. Rashi understands that because Yitzchak was sanctified as a korban, he was an offering on the altar, although he wasn't slaughtered, but he was an offering brought on the altar. He was so holy, he was not allowed to leave the land of Israel. And he's the only one of the Avos did not leave Eretz Yisrael. Avram went to Mitzrayim at the time of the famine. Yaakov spent many years outside of the land of Israel. Yitzchak never left Eretz Yisrael because he was a korban. And if Avram intuited that the proper wife for Yitzchak would be the wife from his family who was living in Mesopotamia outside of Eretz Yisrael, Yitzchak simply could not go. But the Sforim say there's actually a deeper thought here, and that is Yitzchak's passivity manifests itself in a number of ways. Number one, he doesn't choose his wife. Number two, even in the Akedah, he's portrayed as essentially letting Avraham do all this stuff. Now, of course, that was his madrega, great, great madrega, that he's letting his father slaughter him. But you get the whole impression, Avraham is tying Yitzchak, Avraham is holding the knife over Yitzchak. Yitzchak is being acted upon with Yaakov and Esav. The story we're going to read, that Yitzchak wants to bless Esav, and we'll discuss exactly what's that about. And Rivka knows that Yaakov is more deserving. So if you remember the famous difficult story, she has Yaakov impersonate Esav by dressing up like Esav, by wearing the goatskin's hairy arms. And unbeknownst, apparently, to Yitzchak, he winds up giving the bracha, the blessing, to the wrong person. But then he sees if that's what God wanted, then it got to be that way. Once again, the decision to give the blessings to Yaakov instead of Esav was not Yitzchak's decision. Yitzchak seems, again, pashut pshat, Yitzchak seems to have been duped. He seems to have been fooled. People are making the decisions for him. Avraham makes the decision of the Akedah. Eliezer makes the decision of the wife. Rivka makes the decision of which son gets the bracha. Kind of a strange pattern, right? Yitzchak is acted upon as opposed to being the actor. And Kabbalistically, again, this is not going to be a full explanation, but just a perspective. You know, Avraham represents the concretization of the divine attribute of loving kindness, chesed, which is giving. Yitzchak represents the concretization of the divine attribute that is called gevurah. Now, gevurah is often associated with din, but what it really means is withdrawal, concealment, internalization. Yitzchak is kind of removed from this world, focusing on internal spiritual development. And thus, Yitzchak almost does nothing external. Everything external in Yitzchak's life is engineered by others, because Yitzchak represents the koach of gevurah, which is self-contained. Again, this is not a complete explanation, obviously, but the observation is still a noteworthy observation that all of Yitzchak's life decisions are made by other people, and he goes along with it. That's the nation of gevurah. In other words, you're not involved in externalities. You're involved in your own internal work and the like. Now, another comment here is that the Mefarshim point out that in the story of getting Yitzchak a wife, there's an extraordinary amount of repetition, because the Torah kind of repeats the detail over and over and over again. First, we have a conversation between Eliezer and Avraham, where Avraham tells Eliezer, do not take a wife for my son from the Canaanite people that live here. Go to my land and the place of my birth to find a wife. And then Eliezer says, this is the conversation, what if the woman there doesn't want to go? Shall I take your son there? And Avraham says, absolutely not. We'll figure out something, but in other words, there's a double mission here. Go there and bring back a wife. But if the wife doesn't want to come, then you don't take my son there. He does not leave Eretz Yisrael. So that's, we'll call that Act 1. Act 1 is conversation between Avraham and Eliezer. And Eliezer takes an oath, and again, this sounds a little bizarre to us, but this was actually the form of an oath. He took the oath. When you make a Shavua, you're supposed to grasp something sacred, something holy. Today in a Beis Din, if you ever had occasion to make a Shavua, you would hold the Sefer Torah. Well, again, as I say, this sounds a little strange to us, but the place of the Bris Milah, the area of the Bris, is sacred and holy. And Eliezer made his oath by physically holding on to the Makam HaMila of Avraham Avinu. Again, I understand it doesn't sound to modern ears, but again, this was all done in an atmosphere of holiness and sanctity. That is Act 1. Act 2 is Eliezer gets to Haran. Haran is Mesopotamia. Haran is around Iraq. And Eliezer devises a test. Now, who told him to devise the test? Nobody. This is a test he made up on his own. And the test is, I'm going to approach women at random and ask them to draw water from the well and give it to me and to my camels. And the woman that says, not only will I give you, but I will draw water for your camels, that is the right wife. So what happens then is, we don't know how many other women he may have asked, but it's mashma from the pasuk that Rivka is the first woman, that he was really lucked out, right? Like that with the Google search, you know, feeling lucky today, right? So Eliezer was, of course it's all from Hashem, but Eliezer was lucky that day because Hashem blessed him. And the first woman, little Rivka, which according to Chazal is only 3 years old, gave him the water. Now, keep in mind, Eliezer at that point didn't know she was from Avram's family. He immediately gave her the jewelry, and only afterwards he said, by the way, whose daughter are you? And she said, I am Rivka, the daughter of Besuel, the daughter of Nachor, which is Avram's brother. So Rivka is essentially the great niece of Avram. Okay, if again, let's be sure you understand this. Avram had two brothers. There's Avraham, Haran. Don't confuse this. The geographical location is Haran with the Ches. Avram had a brother called Haran, and he had another brother called Nachor. Haran died in the fiery furnace. When Avram was saved, Haran died. Haran is Sarah's father. So Avram and Sarah are uncle and niece. Avram married his niece. Okay. Nachor is Avram's surviving brother. Nachor has a son, Besuel. So Besuel and Yitzchak are first cousins. Besuel has a daughter, Rivka. So Yitzchak and Rivka are first cousins once removed. Okay? I trust that everybody knows the difference between second cousins and first cousins once removed. Okay? Second cousins would be Yaakov and Besuel's other children. Well, okay, I'm getting mixed up myself. Let's go over this again. Yitzchak and Besuel are first cousins. The reason why Yitzchak and Besuel are first cousins is because they are the children of brothers. Avram and Nachor are brothers. Nachor has Besuel. Avram has Yitzchak. Yitzchak and Besuel are first cousins. Rivka is the daughter of Yitzchak's first cousin. Since Rivka is the daughter of Yitzchak's first cousin, so vis-a-vis Yitzchak, Rivka is a first cousin once removed. Now, bizarrely enough, okay, this is very bizarre. Technically, Rivka's son, Yaakov, happens to be her second cousin. But okay, that's a little bizarre. Because the children of first cousins are second cousins. So, all right, okay, that's a little strange. So, technically, Yaakov is the second cousin of his mother. But okay. But okay, but putting that aside. So that's Act Two. So Act Two, right? Act One is the conversation. Act Two is the test. Act Three is the negotiation with Besuel, and then eventually Besuel died, according to Chazal, because Lavan tried to poison poison Eliezer to get the wealth. That's why Lavan takes over. Now, the problem is, in Act 3, Eliezer repeats the whole story of the conversation and the test. Now, the Torah, as he says, I had this conversation and then I devised this test. Now, the problem is, the Torah does not waste words. In Act 3, the Torah could have just said, Eliezer told Besuel everything that happened, and then continue the story. Why in Act 3 does Eliezer repeat the conversation that he had with Avram? And he repeats, the question is not why he, I don't mean to ask why he repeats. It's natural that he would repeat it, but because Lavan and Besuel don't know that story. But why does the Torah repeat it? That's the question. Why does the Torah have to have Eliezer's words in repeating everything? Just say, Eliezer told Besuel and Lavan everything that happened. Instead of saying, Eliezer said there was a conversation. You see, you understand the problem? The problem is that all of those verses are superfluous to us as readers of the Torah, because we already know what the conversation was. We already know the test. And if Eliezer is simply recounting what we already know, the Torah could have said, as it says in many cases, and Eliezer said everything that happened. So the Gemara in Chulin says that this is a sign of how much love Hashem has even for the slaves of the patriarchs. There are many, many halachos that the Torah teaches with an extra word and an extra letter. Why say a sentence if I could teach you it with a letter? And here the Torah repeats, because everything that the Avos do, and everything that even the servants of the Avos do, is so beloved to Hashem that He repeats it. That He repeats it over and over and over again. This is what the Gemara in Chulin says. But other Mefarshim like the Abarbanel say there's something deeper here. And that is, the problem is that when things are repeated, they are not repeated exactly the same way. Eliezer's repetition of his conversation with Avram and with the test is not the same as what actually happened. And therefore the purpose of the Torah repeating it is to teach you to be alert to the differences in the narration. And then you try to figure out, what does that teach me? So this is not a 100% repetition. This is in fact a revision of the story. And there's chidushim in the revision. Now, the Abarbanel lists like 49 differences. Some of them are very, very small. But I just want to mention two or three of them so you'll get the idea. And that is the following. Number one, Eliezer recounts his conversation with Avram, but he switches the request. Avram said, "Go back to my land and my place of birth." Avram did not say, "Go to my family." Avram said, "Go to my land." When Eliezer recounts the story, he switches Avram's words and says, "Avram said, go back to my family." So Avram said, "Go to my land." Eliezer made it sound as if Avram said, "Go to my family." Difference number one. Difference number two. In Avram's initial conversation, he asked, Eliezer asked Avram, "What's going to be if the girl doesn't want to go? Shall I take your son there?" And Avram said, "Never." Eliezer doesn't mention that part of the story. That's an omission. Difference number three. In the test that Eliezer devised, as soon as Rivka passed the test, he gave her the jewelry, and only then did he ask her, "Who are your parents?" When he recounts it to Lavan then, he says, "I asked her, after she passed the test, I asked her who were her parents, and only then I gave her the jewelry." In other words, parentage first, then jewelry. But what actually happened was jewelry and then parentage. So, how many, did I mention three or four? How many did I mean? Three, all right. So we'll just go with that just to make the larger point. So point number one is Avram said lands. Eliezer made it family. Point number two, Eliezer omitted Avram's statement, "Do not take my son there." And number three, Eliezer gave the jewelry and then said basmiat. But when he recounts the story, he says, "I said basmiat, then I gave the jewelry." So here, the understanding is the following. Avram really didn't care about family. Avram was not saying, "Go to my family." Avram was saying, "Go to my land." What's so special about the land? So the Drasha Saran says that Avram knew that the people of his country were very kind and compassionate people. Remember, Eliezer himself had a daughter that he wanted to marry Avram. Marry Yitzchak, yeah. But Avram said no. And the Drasha Saran explains that although Eliezer was a great tzaddik, but he knew the nature of the Canaanites was a cruel nature. And even though Eliezer had overcome the negatives of his nature, but because their nature was cruel, that cruelty could pop out in future generations. But Avram knew that the people from his lands were kind and compassionate, even though they were idol worshippers. Listen to this. The Drasha Saran said it is better to marry an idol, or I don't mean a guy, I mean, this is before Matan Torah, but it's better to marry someone who is not so religious, but has a kind, compassionate nature, more than somebody who's very, very firm, but they lack that kindness. Because religiosity and mitzvos can be developed by education. But cruelty to kindness is a much more difficult process. So Avraham didn't care about family. Avraham was only concerned with kindness. And that's why his mission was geography based. That is how Eliezer knew to devise a test based on kindness. Because you might ask, who told Eliezer that that's what he should be looking for? Answer, the very fact that Avraham is saying, go to my country, is that kindness is what you're looking for. Mimela, Eliezer develops kindness. Now, that is why Eliezer gave the jewelry and didn't have to ask Basmiat, because it didn't make a difference. But here is the point. Eliezer has to convince a hostile family that they should let their 3-year-old go 1,000 miles away. In order for Eliezer to do this, he has to deviate from the truth, which is permitted for Shalom, and he has to butter up his prospective in-laws. Now, the way he butters them up is by saying, the great Avraham sent me to you. Eliezer can't say, he sent me to the country, because that wouldn't be a compliment to Levin. So Eliezer has to say, the famous great Avraham that everybody in the world knows about wants you. That's why he changes it from geography to family. But Eliezer's real smart, because once you lie, you got to be sure your lie is consistent. Because if Eliezer would then say, and I gave her the jewelry, and then asked who she was, so for Eliezer that made sense, because it didn't make a difference who she was. But if he switches it and says, it has to be you, then they would ask him, well, how could you give her the jewelry if you didn't know who she was? So he's smart enough to say, oh, I first asked who she was before I gave her the jewelry. And Eliezer is conveying that the test was not a test of chesed. Eliezer is using the test as a superstition, meaning Eliezer's own motivation was, I'm looking for midos. But for Lavan, he has to play on Lavan's love of superstition, and he's basically saying, this is, you know, decreed in heaven from this, like a black, you know, black cat or a red dress or something. Now, this also explains why he eliminates that little bit of conversation, because when he said to Avraham, what if she doesn't go? Why don't want to go? Shall I bring her there? So Avraham says, God forbid that my son should get filthy with the rishus that exists in that culture. Well, if you're trying to flatter the mechutanim, you don't want to say how awful it would be to live with them. So as a result, Eliezer leaves that out. You understand what's going on? Now, why is this important? This is important because we see how faithful a person Eliezer was. Eliezer had every incentive for this mission to fail. Because if the mission failed, Eliezer might be next in line. At that point, Avraham would have to reconsider. But the point we're making is, not only did Eliezer carry out the mission, but he changed the story to maximize its success. Now, he didn't have to do that. He could have said exactly what Avraham told him. And then if Lavan gets offended, Eliezer could honestly report, I did what you asked me to do, it didn't work. And that would have been enough. But he was so committed to Avraham that he actually went out of his way to guarantee the success of the mission, even though it's against his interest. That is how faithful he is. And this we see in another Nakuda, which is quite amazing. Everybody knows, and I've said it already 10 times, that this faithful servant was Eliezer. Every kid knows that. But you know something? We know Avraham had a servant Eliezer. He's mentioned in other places. His name is not mentioned in this story. If I would ask you, show me in the story, it says there's an Eved Avram. Avram may have had more than one servant. You know, we're so sure that we've seen that in the Chumash. We haven't. The Chumash does not say that the servant that was involved is Eliezer. It does not say. And the Marshal says, this is the greatness of Eliezer. He was so self-effacing that he obliterated his own individual identity. All he was an extension of Avram. That is how much he was mevatel, his own agenda, his own selfish interests and the like. So this is a very, very important idea to think about, that whenever the Torah repeats something, one of the things you pay attention to is not only why something is repeated, but pay attention to why it is repeated in a different way. That sometimes something will be repeated to highlight the differences in the story and the different lessons that you can learn from the story. In fact, let me just mention one more difference. Rivka passed the test, but when Eliezer tells how Rivka passed, he changes a little bit. Eliezer's test was the following. The woman, I will ask a woman for water. If she says, I will give you and your camels, that's the right woman. Okay. Meaning, I'm going to ask for water, and the woman responds, you and your camels. Now, what Rivka did was not exactly that. She did a little differently. Eliezer said, give me water. She gave him water, and after he finished drinking, she said, I will draw new water for your camels. So, did she do 100% exactly the way he said it? She did not. But she did better. The way she did it shows even a greater midah than his test. Reason is, because if the woman responds, I'll give you and your camels, that implies you're like the camels, you're no better. It also implies you better not drink everything up because what I'm giving you is for you and your camels. Rivka waited till Eliezer drank his whole fill, and then she went back for the camels. So number one, she's not equating human and animal. And number two, she's letting Eliezer drink as much as he wants. So did Rivka do exactly the conditions of the test? No. But if the test is to show chesed, she did it even better. But interestingly enough, when Eliezer tells Lavan, he makes it exact. I said, the woman that says, I'll give you and your camels, and says, and Rivka said, I'll give you and your camels. Meaning, he makes Rivka 100%, but he takes away the extra chesed. But the answer is very understandable. Eliezer was not doing a superstitious test. Eliezer was measuring chesed. So if Rivka deviated, she deviated in the direction of more chesed. So that's great. But when Eliezer is using the test in his communication with Laban, Eliezer is trying to make this a superstitious omen. Superstitious omens have to be exact. You can't, right? If there's a little deviation, it's not an omen anymore. And therefore, given Eliezer's purposes, he had to switch it from a chesed test to a superstitious test. And that's why he had to make it exact. Okay, you be well and take care. Oh, by the way, I have to make a very quick trip to Chutz La'aretz.